This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. Cynthia Bulick was deeply familiar with the psychology of women between adolescence and menopause. She's a seasoned researcher and author of two books on eating disorders, and she's the director of the University of North Carolina's Eating Disorders Program. But two encounters in locker rooms led her to worry about girls and older women. She was with some 6 to 8-year-old girls while they were changing to go swimming, and she heard them complain about their bellies and being fat. And then she was with some women in their 70s and 80s in the locker room of a retirement facility, and those women were complaining about being fat and considering plastic surgery. Cynthia realized that body image is a problem for women from cradle to grave. Her new book is called The Woman in the Mirror, How to Stop Confusing What You Look Like with Who You Are. And Cynthia Bulick joins me in the studio today. Welcome back to the program. Good to have you here.
It's great to be back. Thanks, Frank.
We're taking phone calls and emails this hour for Cynthia. If you have a story to share about body image issues or want to join our conversation, call us at 877-962-9862 or send an email at sot@wunc.org. Let's start with the basics, because in your book you distinguish between body esteem and self-esteem. What's the distinction?
Right. So the definition of body esteem is really how you feel about yourself physically, about your body, about your weight, about your shape, about things like your hair, your eyes, your fingernails, really just your appearance. Self-esteem is more of an overarching concept, and that has to do with your relationships, who you are as a person, your personality, your accomplishments, and it also does include your appearance, but it's much more of a global concept, and it's really who you are in the world and how you feel about that.
And so how big a factor is body esteem in establishing self-esteem?
Well, you've absolutely nailed the point of the book, and that is that unfortunately, it becomes too big of a component of self-esteem. And what we're really noticing, these little girls in the locker room, as well as these older women that you mentioned, you know, they're really to the point where they're conflating the two. They're equating their body esteem with their self-esteem. And what we're trying to do through this book is really help women pull those things apart. And as it says in the subtitle, stop confusing what you look like with who you are.
What was it about those two meetings that shocked you? Certainly, you've been doing this work for a long, long time. You understood what was at stake here and the cultural impact, et cetera. And yet these two conversations bowled you over, it seems.
They really did. And, you know, I spend most of my time dealing with adolescents, young adult women, and, you know, women in their 30s and 40s. And there we see what is commonly referred to as normative discontent. And I think it's a really interesting phrase, because what it says is that it's become the norm for women to be unhappy with their appearance or their size. But I was hoping that these little girls would sort of still be protected from that. And I was really hoping that by the time you're 70 or 80, you can be past all of that and be comfortable with your aging body. But what really blew me away in those two encounters was not just that they were complaining about their appearance, but they were rolling it into their self-esteem. It wasn't just a body esteem issue. It became a self-esteem issue. And that's when I said, okay, this conflation problem goes across the lifespan for women.
What's going on? What are the cues that are causing women to conflate those two important?
Well, what's very interesting, I'm going to stick with the older population for a minute. And I talked to some of these women, and what they said was there seems to be no more allowance for aging. So in the past, it was okay to become sort of a zoftic grandmother who, you know, makes pizza sauce or something, and the kids sit on your lap while you read books. And all of a sudden, there's all this pressure to look young, to stay thin, and to be fit. And what it seems to be all the way across the age span is just this parade of shoulds. There are options out there to look a certain way, to change your body in a certain way, and you should take advantage of it. And those shoulds seem to be what's pounding away at women across the lifespan.
And so what impact do they have on eating behavior?
Oh, it's the same thing. Only here we're getting such mixed messages, especially now, given all of the issues with the obesity epidemic. Yeah. So on one hand, we're hearing the importance of the public health crisis associated with obesity. At the same time, we're getting these messages that really perpetuate this normative discontent that says you have to stay thin and fit at any age, at any time.
There are two different messages. I mean, I did wonder about that, because I think at some point you point to a statistic, almost 10% of Division I female college athletes. No, no, that's not the one. I went 30% of 10 to 14 year old girls have some kind of are dieting. 30% of 10 to 14. And I thought, well, how many of them have been told to diet because of a weight problem, and a serious medical weight problem?
And this is such a huge issue at this point. And I have real concerns about some of the language that we're using to talk about childhood obesity. We're using words like the war on obesity, or we have to fight childhood obesity. What we don't want to do is stigmatize overweight in these children at all. It's not the overweight children that we're fighting. We should be fighting big food and big beverage, because that's where the battlefield really should be. So we have to be so careful not to give the message to diet, because that's not what we want them to do. We want them to eat healthfully. We want them to have more physical activity and focus on health rather than a number on the scale.
I'm talking with Cynthia Bulick today. Her new book is called The Woman in the Mirror, How to Stop Confusing What You Look Like with Who You Are. I'm taking your phone calls at 877-962-9862. Are women, young women especially, able to separate those two ideas? Do they see the difference between the health message and the other cultural cues that you will be accepted or not based on how you look?
Well, if you imagine that you're a little girl in third or fourth grade, the thing that's going to be immediately important to you is that sense of acceptance. And I think the peer issue and the peer environment is so critical to look at. You know, and part of what we really need to do, both as parents and as teachers, is to really help make sure that we're fostering an environment that values so much more about girls than just their appearance. One of the things I talk about in the book is how teachers still have a tendency to give boys more attention in classrooms than they give to girls. And despite the fact that girls are often doing better in those classrooms.
Well, or perhaps because of it.
The attention those boys get, it turns out, can be negative attention. But, you know, part of it is at any given time, as a mom, when someone gives your daughter a compliment about how she looks, pair that with something else that's wonderful about her. You know, I have a story in the book about a colleague whose grandmother always says to her daughter, or mother says to her daughter, oh, she looks so beautiful. She's really filling out what, you know, it's always appearance focused. And my very mindful colleague always makes sure that she pairs that with, and she's doing great in school, or, and she's such a responsible dog owner, you know, something to give the message to her daughter that there's so much more of value than her appearance.
Well, and you also point out in the book that they can be fairly benign statements. You use the example of yourself and your grandmother when she was used to, because she was a seamstress, right? Well, I'll let you tell the story.
Yeah, this is a great story. And I love my grandmother, God rest her soul. She was a very large woman. And she made a lot of clothes for me. She made all my skating costumes for me. So I was often being measured. And she would say things to me like, you have a figure just like mine. And granted, I was 11 years old, and I was a normal weight 11-year-old child, but I would look at Grandma's body, and then I would look at my body, and I would be like, oh, what's she seeing that I'm not seeing? And with my 11-year-old brain, I was really worried that maybe I wasn't seeing myself correctly. And it's really interesting, because as children, we look to other people's perceptions of us to form our identity. And I was, you know, collecting information from people, and that was just a little frightening. But now, I mean, she was wonderful. This was a talented woman. She had great friends. She was a wonderful grandmother. And that was just one of those one itty-bitty little comments that stuck, and I had to chew on for a while.
For quite a while, because you talk about coming back to that for years, particularly when you didn't quite fit into the genes that the masters of style created for young girls your age.
Right. And this is one of the things we try to get people to do in the book, because there's some great little worksheets and activities you can do. And I call it thought archaeology. And it's going back in your mind and sort of like dusting off some of these old comments that people have made, because we create libraries from comments that people make about us. So the trick is to go back, pull those comments out, recognizing that you received those comments perhaps with a child's brain. And you weren't able to sort of shine your adult cognitions on what did the person mean when they say that, or how would I interpret it now? So basically what I'm asking you to do is really refurbish your thought library. Go back, re-examine those thoughts, understand them with a clearer adult brain, and that can really help lead to a whole redecoration of your self-esteem.
As we said, one of the sort of the clinical expressions of this is an eating disorder. And clinically, how do we define an eating disorder?
Right. So that really goes beyond normative discontent across that line into the realm of pathology. And we have three main eating disorders. There's anorexia nervosa, which I think is the most popular or known eating disorder, because this is when people lose an inordinate amount of weight and really fear weight gain. Bulimia nervosa can happen in someone at any body weight, and that's marked by binge eating, which is an eating an unusually large amount of food in a short period of time and feeling out of control, coupled with some kind of purging method. The third primary eating disorder is binge eating disorder. And that's the same feature, the binge eating, but in the absence of purging behavior. And that's actually the most common eating disorder.
The most common eating disorder is eating too much, essentially.
Exactly. Overeating. It's binge eating, yes.
877-962-9862 is the number to call if you want to join my conversation today with Cynthia Bulick. Her book is called The Woman in the Mirror, and Danette is on the phone from Raleigh. Hello, Danette.
Hello.
You have a question for us? Sure.
Yes, I had an interesting experience with my daughter when she was 9 years old. She was in ballet, and a pretty little girl and very, you know, promising. And her ballet teacher took me, you know, came up to me very angrily and was in earshot of my daughter, said that her tummy was too poochy and that she was eating too much pasta. And I tried to explain to the teacher that, my daughter had just developed scoliosis, but, you know, that she didn't want to hear it. So I pulled her out, but I was upset that she said this in front of my daughter and that this was such a big point.
Oh, thanks, Danette.
I was shocked.
I bet. And I'm guessing you're not the only mom that heard this, right?
I
mean, you may not know that, but yeah.
I was just concerned about this body image concern with my 9-year-old child. And I don't know if I handled it correctly. I mean, I just removed her from the situation, is what I did, and put her in a different ballet school.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks
for the call, Danette. Cynthia?
Danette, I would say you handled it absolutely beautifully. And I think one of the things that we see so much is that ballet and sport can be so, they can be so positive in terms of building body confidence. But when the coaches or the teachers step in and do something as flagrant as this, it takes all of that benefit away. And, you know, frankly, I would have spoken to the person's boss, too, and it's probably not too late. But this is exactly the kind of thing that we don't need to have happen. These things can be so positive for girls' self-esteem, not just their body esteem, but their self-esteem. And that's what they should be able to take away from their ballet or their soccer or whatever sport they're engaged in.
Yeah, well, that was the other surprising statistic for me. 10% of, may not seem like a big number, but it seemed big to me. 10% of Division I female athletes have problems with bulimia.
Yeah, or some form of disordered eating. And, you know, I think what we're seeing is so much more awareness in coaches now, and trainers, actually. The athletic trainers are ones who are often the ones that hear this. And, you know, there's often pressure to keep girls in the competitive realm during the season. So often what we hear is, let's just get her through the season and see if we can, you know, win or whatever it is, when in reality what you need to do is you need to treat it now. So I think the competing demands can often delay how quickly we can get these girls into treatment.
So the trainers and the coaches, what about parents? How do we recognize the symptoms early on?
Well, and parents as well. I mean, with the trainers and coaches, it's important when the kids are away at college and the parents aren't there all the time.
Right.
But as parents, we have to be vigilant from a very early age on. And, you know, what I tell parents is, if your kid were to come home and say, I'm going to have a beer with dinner, or I'm going to smoke a cigarette tonight, your red lights are going to go off. Your alarm bells are going to be all over the place. You're going to hop on that. When your child comes home and says, I'm going to go on a diet, or I don't like my body, or does this make me look fat, the same alarm bell should go off. And that's a sign that it's time to start having the conversation and bring this to the forefront instead of hoping that it's going to go away, because chances are that it's going to get worse rather than disappear.
And so what do you do at that point? I mean, it is just a simple statement. Does this make me look fat, or I'm going to make my own salad, thanks. How far what do you say at that point?
Well, you keep asking. You say, you know, tell me a little bit more about that. You know, why do you just want a salad tonight? Or, you know, what are your thoughts about this? Or if you start noticing trends, and if it happens once, it's not a big deal. But I always say, once something happens 3 times, then you've got a trend and you have to hop on it. And it never hurts to get a second opinion. Talk to your pediatrician. take your daughter into a dietitian or some other physician just to get a second opinion so that someone else can be asking the questions as well.
Now, if you start to treat this overtly, don't they just go underground and say, okay, they're trying to fix me. I'm going to go find people who will tell me it's perfectly all right. I'll find a community of people just like me.
Well, that can happen, unfortunately, and we run into that problem on the internet all the time with some of these pro-anorexia and pro-bulimia websites, and they are very scary. And luckily what we have done, well, just to for your listeners, these are websites that encourage anorexia as a lifestyle and really don't recognize that this is the most lethal of all psychiatric illnesses. So we've had great success getting a lot of these websites taken down, but some of them still go underground and pop up under different names. But again, as the parent, it's vigilance, it's constantly paying attention, making sure you have regular checkups, watching your daughter's growth curve, you know, listening for things like, does she go to the bathroom all the time after meals, and then compassionately letting her know that you're worried about her.
It's shocking, isn't it? Here we are, more than 40 years of feminist thinking in mainstream media. We talk about this. We talk about women's bodies not being the most important thing, and yet it seems to be. Is it a bigger problem today than it was 40 years ago when we first said, let's stop talking that way about women?
Yep. I like the fact that you frame it in sort of feminism. And what's interesting about that is, you know, we've had three waves of feminism now. You know, we can vote. We're working on equal pay. We've got Title IX, so we can participate in sports. But I think in some ways, this book almost represents the fourth wave of feminism. And from my perspective, what we're seeing is the last frontier of feminism is actually in our own minds. And that's where we need to do the work now, because we could have equality on all of those external factors. But if we still look in the mirror and our self-esteem suffers because we think we don't look good, there's still work to do. And that might be where the last feminist battle has to be fought.
And there are a lot of mirrors involved here in developing self-esteem. You start very early in the book with the case of a story about a girl named Maya and her pretty princess fantasy. Tell us that story, because I think it illustrates how early these ideas set in.
Yes. Maya was from Wisconsin, I believe, and she loved playing pretty princess. And Princess Jasmine was her favorite movie figure. And she had every single little bit of princess regalia you could imagine. She had tiaras. She had different dresses of all colors. Every Halloween, she dressed up as a princess. And then just one day, she was watching Princess Jasmine on DVD. And she had a mirror in her room. And she stood sideways. And she looked at Princess Jasmine's tummy. And then she looked at her tummy, much like Danette was talking about, actually. And her tummy wasn't as flat as Princess Jasmine's was. And she just all of a sudden said, I'm not like her. I'm not a princess. She took off her princess costumes. She put them all in the back of her closet. And she never went back to her princess fantasy play again. Her mom had no idea what happened. But it was that moment looking in the mirror and that comparison with Princess Jasmine that turned her off and started her negative body esteem.
Now, was that negative body esteem, or was she just putting aside a foolish fantasy and sort of moving into the real world? I'm not that person, and perhaps I don't need to be, or I don't want to be. What happened to Maya is my question.
I wish it could be that way. What Maya ended up doing on that day, as she recounted the story, is she went downstairs to comfort herself with cookies and milk. And so Maya was really sad about this whole loss. It was a sense of loss for her, not a sense of liberation from her princess fantasies. And then she ended up being someone who really did turn to food for comfort. So unfortunately, in Maya's case, it really was a sad story and not a positive story.
On the State of Things today, my guest this hour is Cynthia Bulick, author of The Woman in the Mirror, How to Stop Confusing What You Look Like with Who You Are, also the director of the University of North Carolina Eating Disorders Program. And our conversation will continue in a few moments. We're going to take a short break. After that, we'll take your phone calls at 877-962-9862, emails at sot@wnc.org. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. We're talking this hour with Cynthia Bulick, author of The Woman in the Mirror, How to Stop Confusing What You Look Like with Who You Are. She's the director of the University of North Carolina Eating Disorders Program. Taking your calls this hour, if you have a question for Cynthia, give us a call at 877-962-9862 or a story to tell. give us a call or send us an email at sot@wunc.org. I want to stick with this idea of mirrors for a moment and wonder and ask you about the difference between the way men see themselves and women in this culture.
Well, one of the things I did when writing the book was I spent a lot of time in women's rooms. And I watched as women came in and looked at themselves in the mirror. Now, obviously, I couldn't do the same thing in men's rooms without getting into some trouble, but I did spend a lot of time in the women's rooms. And interestingly, when I watched their faces when they approached the mirror, they never approached the mirror with a smile, except maybe if they were looking to see if they had something between their teeth and they had to give themselves a little grin to see if there was something there. But they always approached the mirror with this look of skepticism or negativity or almost fear of what they were going to find. And so in talking to just hundreds of women about this, what I learned is that women use the mirror as a flaw detector. So they basically go to the mirror, they scan from head to toe, and they catalog what's wrong. And it's always, the eyes are too far apart, the nose is too big, this is crooked, the hair's not right. But it's all about detection of flaws. When I talk to men about this, I don't get the same response. In fact, guys say, no, I'm not looking for what's wrong. I have this wonderful quote from an older woman who says, I look in the mirror and see a saggy old woman. I swear he looks in the mirror and still sees the reflection he saw when he was in high school. And there's something about how guys interact with their reflection that's a little healthier than what we women are doing.
Maybe that sheds some light on this crazy phenomenon. Like if two guys, you know, like if the two guys with the same T-shirt in a room at a party, they, you know, that's high fives. Hey, you got the memo, right? And two women, it's like same dress, big problem, right?
It's horror. Yeah. That's right. It's a major, I'm going to run away and get a new dress.
Yeah. So then maybe it's more than just the fact that the kinds of pressure we put on women are certainly different than the expectations for men, but also the way, the psychology of developing a self-image and the way we see ourselves.
Right, and the way they get interpreted. Yeah. Exactly.
877-962-9862 is the number to call. Susan is on the line from New Hill. Hello, Susan.
Hi, Frank. Your show today is really interesting. I had a shocking episode happen to me last summer. When I was a teenager, I first starved myself, kind of borderline anorexia. I dropped about 35 pounds, and then I discovered bulimia. And it's taken me a long time, and I've really worked through my body image issues. But I went on a trip with my daughter and one of her friends, my friend's mom, and this woman's the same age as I am. I'm 47. And she is perpetually benchmarking what food she eats versus what I eat, and is measuring portions and looking at calories. And in the obsessive way I probably would have done 20 years ago. And it was just startling to see a person at this point in their life still having all those negative images.
Thank you, Susan.
Susan, first off, congratulations to you for working through both the anorexia and the bulimia and getting some peace with your body image. But, you know, this is the new trend. We used to think that eating disorders were primarily something that happened to white, upper middle class adolescent girls. Nothing could be further from the truth. In fact, the biggest trend that we're seeing now is an increase in eating disorders in girls before puberty, and then an increase in exactly the age group that you're talking about. So the demographic has completely shifted. And what we're seeing in our clinic is many more women in their 40s, 50s, and 60s, and men as well in this age group, who are presenting with eating disorders, either for the first time or they've been suffering all along since adolescence.
Is this new for men? The incidents, the number of incidents you're seeing?
If we had good epidemiology in this country, I could answer that question, but we don't know. And in fact, in a lot of the surveys, we haven't asked men about eating disorders. So we need to start asking now so that we can trace trends in the future.
Let's go back to the phones. Maura is on the line from Chapel Hill. Hi, Maura.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I appreciate the show, and I agreed with the statement about the last frontier, this being the last frontier in feminism. But I would also like to suggest that I feel that the aspect of sexism that focuses on body image and that sees a woman's worth as in her body only, I feel that that has actually amplified and gotten worse, perhaps in the past 30 years or so, and that in all forms of media, whether it be from magazines to internet to movies, that you know, this focus of a woman's importance, her worth, and being in her appearance, where the men counterparts can be smart, they can be dashing, they can have character, but the women's importance, the women's worth is nested in her appearance and being skinny and young and so on and so forth.
Thanks, Maura.
Thank you.
Maura, I have like three answers to that. I think it's such an important point. And there's a documentary called Misrepresentation that is worth watching. We're going to be screening it during National Eating Disorders Awareness Week on the UNC campus. So keep your eye open for that. I also agree that it has gotten worse. And it's gotten worse in another domain as well, and that is lyrics to songs. That's a dimension that you didn't talk about that I think sometimes I just have to turn the radio off because they're just such appalling lyrics about how they treat women. And the other part of it that I agree with and extend is that the target age for this is getting younger and younger and younger. So we're seeing this over-sexualization of very young girls. And as a parent and as a father, I imagine that's just such a difficult thing to deal with.
You know, it's interesting, though, what this leaves you with is a real paradox. You say, on the one hand, this last frontier is taking control of our own image, a kind of taking back the night, as it were, and yet these images keep coming at us at higher and higher velocity. I mean, is this about women, figure this out, you're going to have to meditate, you're going to have to take control of this while these images keep coming, or is this a two-front war? How do we approach this?
Yeah, I like it, a two-front war. I mean, at no point did I mean to suggest that those external battles are done. We still have to fight those external battles of equality on the big media front, in terms of equality, in terms of getting enough time off when we have babies and we need to breastfeed. All of those wars we have to forge ahead with. But simultaneously, we have to be working on that internal war. In fact, working on those thoughts is going to empower us to be more effective in fighting those external battles.
George is on the line from Rougemont. Hello, George.
Good morning.
How are you doing? You have a question for us?
No, I was listening to the comment the previous caller made about watching women pay great attention to detail in the ladies' room. And she was impressed that men would say that they don't. But men actually do, at least if you're in a position where public impression is considered by your employer to be important. And I was in the medical field all of my career, and we certainly did consider that to be important, at least to get the confidence of the patient.
Well, thank you, George. You know, I wonder if there are just different markers for men too, in terms of their appearance, whether it's clothes over body type or something else.
No, exactly. And George, men do it, and men vary a lot in terms of how they do it as well. I mean, it was a gross overgeneralization if we're just looking at the means of women and the means of men. I think one of the things that I heard talking to men that they spend a lot of time looking at in the mirror is their hairline. And that's something that I think women spend a lot less time looking at. So, you know, I think there are definitely different domains that men pay attention to in the mirror. And that really is just an index of what's important to them.
Susan is on the line from Cary. Hi, Susan.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. This is such a great topic and clearly, could talk for hours. But I just wanted to make, a reference to a previous caller talking about just the media and the world and all that, but I think so much of this, as in so many things, you really have to start a focus at home. And a lot of the suggestions of paying attention and, you know, looking for something that might be a habit is making an assumption that you've got some, like, good, aware parents. I see so many parents as being the issue, having especially just come off of Christmas with in-laws, and I'm hoping we didn't use my last name here, but like I have a sister-in-law who grew up a little heavy. Now she's incredibly thin. I would easily bet she's got an eating disorder with two daughters, 9 and 11, and you know, you can be around them and see that their every move, even at those ages, is, you know, should I pick up that potato chip? Should I, you know, eat that piece of bread? I think that I'd love to see some kind of really scary documentary focused to parents to try to get probably particularly mom's attentions that, you know, do not do this to your daughter.
All right, Susan, thanks very much. Parents.
Yep. Susan, it's really interesting. We just finished a study of a program that we developed called Nurture. And this program was designed for mothers who had histories of eating disorders to help them with parenting, to help them with food and body image related parenting issues. And the amazing thing about it, it was the only study I've ever done where no one has dropped out. But the very interesting result that come from it is all of these women have said that this should not just be a program for people who have a history of eating disorders. Every parent needs to go through this program. So that has really opened our eyes to just what a challenge it is for any parent, regardless of their eating history, to help their children navigate these tricky waters and not model those behaviors themselves. From my perspective, parents are our best allies. So the more that we can do to train parents up to help us in dealing with these issues, the better off we're going to be.
Well, one thing Susan said is that especially mothers, what are there different roles for dads? I'm sure they have a very important role. How different is their role and what they model?
Yep. We have underestimated the importance of fathers when it comes to daughters' self-esteem and body esteem. And, you know, I think now is the time to really start looking at that. We have another program that we did called Dads, which is specifically for fathers. And it helps them figure out, how do you talk to your daughter about body image? If your daughter comes walking down the steps with an itty-bitty little skirt on and a little camisole and looking way over-sexualized for her age, how do you say, honey, you're not going out the door looking that way? And keeping her self-esteem intact and having that conversation. The most important thing is, as a father, your job is to protect her. And this is another form of protection. Just like you protect her when she drives, when she's doing things on the internet that you're worried about, it's the same thing. And as a parent, it's your right and your obligation to do that.
Let's go back to the phones. And Elaine, who is in Greensboro. Hi, Elaine.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
Thank you so much for taking my call. I just wanted to thank the author so much for the work that you're doing. I've just been cheering listening to this broadcast the entire time it's been on. I frequently discuss with my friends the question of where has the feminist movement gone? It seems like we got the right to vote and gave up. And we're pushing against these feelings in our own mind and in our own culture as women amongst ourselves. And there's not enough, I think, popular access to women really being critical about the over-sexualization that you were discussing in the media. I think women have begun to conflate sexual freedom and sexual liberty with personal empowerment and being a liberated female. And I'd be curious what your comments are on that.
Thanks, Elaine.
Yeah, Elaine, well, first off, thanks for the thanks. I very much appreciate that. And, you know, I do think that this is really critical. And at one point I sort of joked, but I meant it. You know, it's one thing to burn your bra, but if you go look in the mirror and your self-esteem plummets because you don't like how you look without a bra on, then there's still more work to do. And I think that's the stage that we're really looking at. And I think we do. I think Frank used this term before. We had to take back the night. You know, I think it's time to resurrect these thoughts and to really make sure that if we call it feminism or if we call it equality, whatever word we use to call it, but that we keep these things in the forefront and don't let them go underground, because we really do have more opportunities now. But if you look at the collective amount of female brain time that is spent dealing with body image issues and food-related issues, there's no wonder that we're not as prominent in Congress as we might want to be. Or whenever you look at the newspaper, the vast number of people out that you see in the pictures are men. It's because so much of our brain time is sucked into these concepts. So we almost need to be liberated from that in order to free more brain space so we can do all of the other things that we're capable of doing.
And, you know, one of the challenges that Elaine might be pointing to is, what do you do if you say, yeah, you have an absolute right and we work very, very hard for you to have the right to look any way you want? And if you're going to use your sexuality as the means of liberating yourself economically, you go ahead and do it. But you can still be critical about cultural norms that are shaped through the media and be very critical about an over-sexualized society with messages that are too sexual and say, but in the meantime, yeah, we know that there are some women who use that, and God bless them and Godspeed. And I think that's the conundrum that Elaine thinks activists find themselves in. There is language to sort of embrace both of those goals.
Well, there is, and they're not entirely incompatible, because it really is the freedom to choose. And it's choice that we're really talking about. And all, there's room for all of those things. But there's also a really important role for all of us to fight against exposure to things that we find offensive or that our children find offensive. And that's fair game for people to speak out against.
So now, you mentioned in the book that you've got two daughters. What have they taught you about all of this?
You know, they're really... My daughters are a little laboratory. I learned so much from them.
Well, they'll be happy to hear that.
And it probably mortifies them whenever I talk about them on the air or write about them in the book. But, you know, the most important thing that I've learned from both of my daughters and my son is that you have to let your children be who they are. You cannot put children into a box that you want them to be in. And the more you let them do that, the cooler things that you find out about them.
Which doesn't mean that they can always dress like they want.
No, but it also means that I don't, you know, at the age of 18, I don't put pink bows in their hair anymore.
Cynthia, what a pleasure. Always good to talk with you.
Likewise, Frank. Thank you.
Cynthia Bulick, the author of The Woman in the Mirror, How to Stop Confusing What You Look Like with Who You Are. She is also the director of the University of North Carolina Eating Disorders Program. Cynthia reads from her book Sunday, January 15th at McIntyre's Books in Farington at 2 o'clock. That's the state of things for today. Thank you for listening. If you want to hear an archived edition of the program or you have a comment, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Alex Granados. Robin Copley is the technical director. Managing editor is Lindsay Foster Thomas. And Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.